On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the beginning, the true beginning of the personal computer revolution, there were two Steves. Steve Jobs, the iconic Apple Computer CEO who still strides the corporate stage of iPods and megadeals today, and Steve Wozniak, the cult icon, the true geek, the engineer, the guy who actually got it done. Steve Wozniak, Woz as he was known, is the man who created, who built the world's first personal computer with his own hands and his own world-changing computer geek gusto. Jobs may be the face of Apple cool today, but Woz was the soul of the machine. Now he's talking about life and computers and world-changing glory days. Joining me now from Seattle is Steve Wozniak. His new book is I Was, From Computer Geek to Cult Icon, How I Invented the Personal Computer, Co-Founded Apple, and Had Fun Doing It. Steve Wozniak, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Pleasure to be on your show.
I've heard you out in public talking about the book, and I just have to say right off the bat, it's just great to have you and your voice and your kind of geek view, and I mean that with the greatest respect, out in the world. What took you so long? It's great to hear from you.
Actually, you know what? I'm a shy person. I like to be quiet. I like to kind of hide out from the world. And the book really got done because I had a co-writer and the discipline of having to do it once I told her I would do it with her. But I started a book a couple other times and just returned the money and said, oh, I've got more interesting things going on. I don't have time to do this. I have wanted to get stories out that would inspire young people to think that being a technical geek-like person, being shunned by others maybe, but really believing in what you do and loving to create new things on your own, that it's a valuable enterprise in life. It's a valuable way to spend your time. And if I'm going to be, you know, some kind of cult icon for those sort of people, I want to be a good one. If I'm going to be a hero, I want to be a good hero. And my stories are very, very honest, and it's all in my own voice, the way I talk. Sure, some book reviews said, well, it's a little bit scattered. Yeah, that's the way I talk.
And who cares? It's a great story, and it's just wonderful to have you with us. Yes, this is the book as written with, as told to, kind of, with Gina Smith, a journalist, I guess, and friend of yours. And we're really glad you're out there with it. So many great stories in here, and we really want to hear them. I was struck right at the beginning. You talk about your father's influence on your life. He was also an engineer, couldn't talk much about a lot of his work, turned out to do with rocket science, I guess, or missiles. But you say that he believed in honesty, extreme ethics, and that it really sunk in with you that to this day you never lie, not even a little, unless you count playing pranks on people, which you don't. Is that a fact?
Playing pranks and jokes. I actually grew up and I even told my kids that basically it's worse to lie about something than to have done it if it's wrong. But, you know, it's like if you're under oath, it's just worse to even lie about murder than to have done it. And that's the way I was brought up. And I thought that everyone was brought up with this kind of sense. I mean, you aren't a person unless people who know who you really are. What are you if you're putting one word out and you have another side that's inside? It's like being a hypocrite. And if you have two little voices in the same head that are saying opposite things, that's a good source for neuroses.
We hope that you'll stick with that full truth philosophy in this hour with us, Steve Wozniak, because it makes life a lot more obviously honest and a lot more interesting. We're glad you're with it, Honest. Talk to us about a couple of numbers. First, there's a discussion here of your IQ, which emerged early on in some testing. What is that? And also, we may have young listeners, maybe computer geeks themselves, and again, I say that with great respect, who want to know what can happen in this kind of world. What about your IQ, and what about your fortune from Apple? Big, small, medium?
Sure. I don't like talking about IQ like it's relevant. I mean, basically, everyone is so smart, and a lot of what we call intelligence is just having read the exact same books and stories as everyone else, even if it's from newspapers or from a history class. Just knowing the same facts is called intelligence, and really there's no thinking involved in that. I was measured with a 200-plus IQ when I was in elementary school, and I was very strong in math and science my whole life, getting awards from my schools and all, but I don't like to think of myself as having been a genius to come up with this great idea of personal computers. The book will go through through. There were just a lot of accidents. I was in the right places at the right time. I had done prior projects just because I loved a fun mm-hmm. life, building neat things that were fun, and I was in the right place to build that sort of computer at a time, and it didn't necessarily come from my genius. Now, the fact that the design was extremely high-quality engineering, extremely tight, direct code, and people who know those things look at it and they say, whoa, this guy is like a Mozart, like an artist in those ways. That part is my real, high IQ showing up. I mean, I was a good engineer. The one thing I don't care about being known for having started Apple, for having started personal computers, but for having done excellent engineering on those products, I definitely want to be known for.
And talk to us about the money side, the payoff. It's very obvious that was not your inspiration here, but it's a part of life and people are always curious. Apple has turned into an enormous business. Were you rich at the beginning? Or are you rich still?
People will catch that aspect in the book very strongly. I grew up with strong philosophies about basically right and wrongness in the world. And basically, money corrupts, and I didn't want to be near money. I would never run a company. I worked at Hewlett-Packard, an engineer's company, started,
it's
run,
Hewlett-Packard before Apple.
Before Apple. Mm-hmm. Not the Hewlett-Packard of today mm-hmm. either. We yep. had such great values. Everything was for the engineers. They were respected. They could come up with the ideas that would drive the company in a new product direction right from the bottom of the org chart. And I made up my mind. I would stay an engineer at the bottom of the org chart for the rest of my life. I would never run a company. I couldn't be political. I was too kind and caring to fire people, to tell them their work was lousy and to criticize them and override one mm-hmm. person with another's ideas. I just couldn't do that sort of thing. Starting Apple was very tough. I designed these computers not to start a company. I passed out schematics, code listings, mm-hmm. everything necessary for you to build your own computer at our computer club, passed them out for free and gave them away as a way to say, you can have your own computer. Here is the way to build a complete computer at the lowest possible cost imaginable. And that was my intent. And Steve Jobs did come along and say, why don't we start a company? And just to have a company of our own and save people some time, in putting the things together. And one thing led to another, led
to
a
You went to
thing.
HP before you did that and said, are you interested in this personal computer, essentially? They said, not really. So off you went.
I had 5 turndowns at HP. I wanted my company to do this. They should have done it. Right. But if they had done it, if they had, and they actually did a little ways along the line, their own project, they would have done it all the wrong product for the reasons of the market that they already appealed to, where their thinking already was. Their sort of product wasn't the imaginative, fanciful product. The funness of even a name, Apple, of color, of mm-hmm. graphics, so many things, games that had to go along with the personal computer. I'm sorry that HP didn't do it. I love that company. By the way, yeah. I kept working at HP as I designed the Apple I and the Apple II, and we had a company, and we sold them. I worked at HP because I had official releases and turndowns from Hewlett-Packard.
Right. So you could, and you could do it on the side. Don't duck the money question, though, here. We're going to look at all your passions, but people always are interested when they see the rest of a life like yours, whether you had to work again or not. I mean, did you come out
a zillionaire
or not?
I was going to lead up to the money.
Yes, sir.
Leading up to the money. When we finally had someone willing to invest money in us, mm-hmm. Steve Jobs and I had zero. We had zero in a bank account or anything, and this Apple II was the greatest design of all time. And this gentleman was willing to put $250,000 in. In mm-hmm. today's dollars, that might be millions. Mm-hmm. And I had a tough decision. I had to leave Hewlett-Packard, he said. I said, why leave Hewlett-Packard? I've designed 2 computers. I've done cassette tape interfaces. I've done video, dynamic RAM. I wrote a BASIC on my own. Yeah. I did all this stuff in a year while working at Hewlett-Packard.
You
I
loved
want
it.
Hewlett-Packard for my job for life. And he said, you got to leave Hewlett-Packard. And my answer was, I thought it over, and there was an ultimatum date. And on the ultimatum date, I said, no, because I went inside myself for the answer. Mm-hmm. I didn't say you should just take money because it sounds like big money. You should think who you are. And as a person, I was an engineer at Hewlett-Packard for life, and I could design computers for fun every night that I felt like it anyway. Mm-hmm. So I said no, and I finally got turned around when a friend convinced me, you can start this company and remain an engineer. It's okay. You don't have to run it. Once one other person said that, I felt relieved that it was okay for me to say it. Until then, I was too shy to say it myself. I didn't want to run a company. Mm. But we started Apple, and I did my engineering, did it excellent, didn't try to do other people's jobs. And, we did generate an incredible amount of money. It just shocked you how much more you can get in life than you could ever need or use. And it felt almost wrong and bad. I, very early, young age, tried to give as much as I could to museums in San Jose and make my community better and schools and you know, help hundreds of people. I would just give them computers or money to go back to school. And I would always say I didn't want to feel the lack of friendship. So I never said, you'll pay me back. I said, the way you pay me back is when you're in a position to give to others, you give it on, and then you'll pay me back that way. You help somebody else out when you're in a better position than they are. And many people over the years have written me back to tell me how they did that and how much it meant to them.
You come across, we've got just a minute before the break, you're a very earnest man. There's a kind of idealism embedded in your view of the world. Have you ended up feeling justified, redeemed in that, or disappointed in the world, Steve Wozniak?
Oh, you never, no, never justified. I had clues to my own happiness. Everyone can develop their own keys to happiness. And I had my keys when I was about 20 years old, thought out some philosophies about, one of them was that I was a good person. Very, you know, trustworthy, caring, generous, all those kind of good attributes that if somebody's bad to me, I'll still be nice to them. And you know what? Those keys, I told myself, make me happy. And they've made me happy for life. That basically you can be happy. You don't have to worry things have to turn out a certain way or I'll be upset, because then you're going to get upset all the time. So once I had those keys, I was happy long before Apple for the rest of my life. And that happiness is how you're going to measure life, not how many yachts you have, what's your title, fancy clothes, big salary, you know, big title, not even grades in school. It's really just how happy are you as you walk around every day.
Mm. Steve Wozniak, there's such great stories in here. I wish you'd take us all the way back to when you were in Mr. McCollum's class. I think that was junior high school, if I've got, or early high school, if I've got that
right.
That
was actually high school.
High school.
About a junior.
A junior in high school, you were just chewing up this electronics class. He had kind of farmed you out because you'd learned what he had to teach in a way to Sylvania, and there you got to program a computer. You say, the first time I really got face-to-face with a computer I could program, after that there was no turning back. And you tell this story of trying to write a program for the computer to do what's called the Knight's Tour. And I love the way that story evolved. What's the Knight's Tour? What were you up to and what did you learn there?
Certainly. Well, first of all, computers had been a big thing in my life. I'd sort of self-taught myself a lot about them. And I'd been heavily into electronics, having had a ham radio license since sixth grade. So I was advanced in the school's electronics. And Mr. McCollum found a way for me to get some education beyond the school, programming this computer. The Knight's Tour is a classic chess problem where a knight piece jumps around using valid knight piece moves, jumps around the chessboard trying to hit every one of the 64 squares once and once only. Mm-hmm. And if you try it on your own, you get trapped at a certain point. There's no place for the knight to go that it hasn't already been.
Right.
So I wrote a program to do that, and it would back up and try a different move, and then back up and back up. It's called a backtracking algorithm, and it just sat there and flashed the lights, and the engineer told me it was in a loop. Well, when I actually studied the program,
in a loop that is an infinite loop, computers can get stuck on. Infinite loop as in the current address of Apple's headquarters now.
It's kind of like when a computer freezes on you. It's actually in a loop. It's doing some dumb things inside, and it can't get loose, and everyone has a computer freeze on them. Well, I couldn't understand what the problem was. Mm-hmm. I couldn't find it in my program. Finally, I did a calculation. I figured out my program wasn't going to have an answer for 10 to the 25th years.
10
longer
to the 25th.
Than the universe.
Longer than the universe has been around. So even at calculations of a million calculations a second, it was going to take longer than the universe had existed for you to get your answer.
I was shocked that doing a million things a second, you couldn't answer some problems. It took a human intellect, a human intelligence, a creative approach to solving the problem. And I thought a computer going fast could do anything. It just goes so fast. So that was a little bit of a shock at that point in time.
What did you learn from it?
I learned that, yes, some problems aren't just solvable by the simple approach. You have to do some thinking and write out the proper steps in a computer program to get them solved efficiently.
So raw computing power would not be enough. Describe the creation of the first personal computer for us. The pieces you put together, what you were thinking when you did it. You're sort of, what was it called? You had the gang that hung out in the garage.
The Homebrew Computer Club.
Right.
Actually, they didn't hang out in a garage. We didn't really hang out in a garage, although the garage was close to our heart.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we're scattered. We're two kids with no money at all. I'm designing computers at Hewlett-Packard and in my apartment. Steve is making phone calls to stores and dealers from his house and parts suppliers and magazines to get publicity.
Steve Jobs was 4 years younger than you here. And in, how old were you each when this was going on in 75,
21, 25.
Okay. And had you built it already or you were planning to build it? How did you first put it together?
I was... I was extremely skilled at computer design, and I had even built a little computer of my own design 5 years before. Now there were a bunch of companies putting out kits of parts at a low affordable cost. You could build something that was the start of a computer. It claimed to be a computer. It looked like a computer. Big front panel and flashing lights, and it looked like an airplane cockpit, one of those things a normal human being doesn't really want to ever get near. I had already been there. I worked at Hewlett-Packard, where we had human calculators that any human could walk up and punch some numbers in, and it went in the display. And I knew how those calculators worked inside. I worked on them, designing them. And I said, why don't we build a computer that has a human keyboard, and when you type things on it, it causes the right things to happen that these big front face plates that the old computers used to have. Why don't you make the computer like a typewriter?
So you can interact directly with its consequences, with its result. Yeah.
Yeah, computers used to have tons of switches and lights. I had already built one 5 years before, and many years before that, in high school, I designed one after another, excelling in my ability to design these things. But so I said, why not make it like a typewriter? All it took was a little program that when you turned the power on, this tiny little program was running. It was only 256 bytes, and it let you type on a human keyboard to operate the computer, to get data into memory, to examine on your TV set what was in memory, and to run a program. The real key to it was the keyboard and the TV I had built the year before, just to have a little terminal of my own that I could show off to friends. Look, I can call computers attached by this thing called the ARPANET. Computers in Boston, Berkeley, Stanford, UCLA, a bunch. There were about 12 computers around the country, and I could log on to different ones. And I never really had a use for those computers to use them, but I was impressed that I was able to build a device to do it. Those computers spoke English onto my television set.
And pretty soon
I typed English on a keyboard.
Right.
And I said, so to build the computer, I said, get rid of that faraway computer in Boston at MIT.
Yeah.
Get rid of it. Put this little chip microprocessor, which is the guts of a computer, the brains of a computer with a little memory. Put it, attach it to the terminal I had already built.
Right in front of you.
It was such a logical, simple step for me. It didn't take great genius. I had been working on just the right things in my life to be able to do this. And that gave me a very quick, not designed from the ground up to be a computer, but it worked as a computer called the Apple I. Steve Jobs, you know, had this idea to start a company, and we didn't think we'd get our money back, but we just would have a company of our own, two best friends with their own company. And that was the start of Apple. Now, that was such a shortcut in a design, but every computer since the Apple I came with a keyboard that looked like a typewriter. Every computer before it didn't. It came with a big front panel of ugly lights and switches. You know, it's the whole concept, the paradigm. What is a computer? It's a simple concept, but someone has to do it first. And it's the first one's always the hardest to do.
And then came Apple II and sales of millions of units of this thing and the whole story that followed. What about your role and Steve Jobs? What was Steve Jobs' role in the midst of all this? While you're in there, up to your elbows, designing this thing.
I was pretty much just trying to almost show off my abilities, do what I always did in my spare time, design neat little products that would do things in your own life, your own home for yourself, had a lab at home, had all the parts and the tools, and I could go into work and have equipment to build these things. Steve always had inspirations for bigger, greater things in life, you know, the Shakespeare, Einstein, Isaac Newton type things. He wanted to, you know, and he always had ideas to have a company and take, you know, one of these big, big companies in the world. So he would come up with the idea to see a product and say, let's sell it. And he would start establishing, how does our business run? What do we need? How do we get some publicity? Who do we sell it to? You know, working on the phone, and he'd have good inspiration. I was so advanced in design that he couldn't really do any of the design or even really the ideas that were in those first computers. When we got funded to be a real corporation, and this was a hard one, this was the one I said no to and then changed my mind. When we got funded, our roles were actually defined by Mark Markla, who was investing the money. Steve and I were 21 and 25. How could we have done such amazing things at such a young age? I still look back and can't believe it. But Mike Markla was a little older, experienced. He had retired from the rat race with, you know, a stock option. He said, well, his role would be marketing because he had done marketing, was good at it, and believed we should be a marketing-run organization.
That is, Steve Jobs' role would be marketing, that is.
My role was obvious. I was the engineer. I was engineering. Steve Jobs' role, no, was going to really be, he had even more than marketing. He had the inspiration to affect tons of people and put good products out and make a company and sort of the whole idea behind the company. So he would float around and do a little bit of everything and be like learn to be an executive in all the categories of a company. An undefined role, not a specific role at the time, but really that he was – the way he spoke and the way he inspired people was so important to having a company. I think that, credit to a company like Apple goes much more to that sort of person than even the person who invented and designed the thing, myself. Like I said, all I want credit for is being a good engineer.
We hear it, two pals and a whole lot of history, a lot of lives changed. Steve Wozniak, we've got a lot of listeners who would like to speak with you. May I turn to them?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Good. Let's go to Spencer, Massachusetts, and Charlie. Hi, Charlie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Fascinating program.
Wonderful. What do you think?
I want to thank Mr. Wozniak for helping make the PC available to everyone. I am blind and hard of hearing. And with a talking program on my computer, I am able to go on the Internet and dig up all kind of information and listen to it that I would not be able to get by going to a library or something like that. Also, it enables me to write letters on my printer. I could not do it by hand.
So blind, deaf, and empowered by the world Steve Wozniak helped crack open.
Exactly, and I cannot tell you and Mr. Wozniak how grateful I am to the freedom and liberty and adventure.
I have to tell you, I was not inspired by having a company, by having money. It was by the other socially minded young people in our homebrew computer club, 500 people talking about how are we going to help the world? How are we going to empower even the small guys to basically have a tool that's going to get them further in life than even the tools of their company can get them? They can kind of turn the ropes and give them more calculating power than their companies. And of course, helping people like yourself who really need the assistance. And we had the ability to design things that would do that. And that's absolutely the inspiration that just drove my heart. Every 2 weeks, it was the most important day of my life to go to that club where people talked about how are we going to be helpful to others. That's why I gave away the circuits and the schematics for free, because it was my way to help. When we came out with the Apple II, boy, we made the documentation so open that others, you aren't one of them, could learn computers, learn how they're built, how they work. So much documentation, because I wanted to help others learn the way I had learned, quietly, shyly, not asking others, not having teachers.
Charlie, we're very grateful for your call and glad for everything that's been opened up here. Let's take another call from Tappahannock, Virginia. Gloria's on the line. Hi, Gloria. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I just had a question. It seems, after listening to this gentleman very clearly, that he's very passionate about what he does. Mm-hmm. And during the 90s, Apple sort of had to endure that whole Microsoft deal, the way they behaved as a company. And now Apple seems to be in the forefront with the MP3 technology, and they seem to be the leader. And it seems that, strategically, the company has made decisions sort of mirror a little bit what Microsoft did. And I refuse to believe that your host feels that way. And I wanted to sort of get his feedback on where the company has taken, what direction has taken, and if he wants to make any comments about it.
Gloria, thanks. Steve Wozniak, you're still on the payroll at Apple, I read anyway, at some level, but you're a pretty candid guy. You've been critical of the iPod emphasis. Gloria goes further. She says, has Apple become more like Microsoft? What do you think of the direction of Apple over the last decade and today?
Actually, I don't think that way so much. I mean, Apple's had some very major up and downs because it pretty much had only one product. Now it has two. I'm very much a fan of the iPod, but I'm an analytical engineer, and I won't just buy into something because it's from Apple. The day the iPod came out, I stacked it up against other technologies I was using for music. Music's a big part of my life, and I didn't rate it plus or minus yet until I tried and used it. Boy, it just took me over. Some products just fit the human being. This is a concept of Steve Jobs's. Look for things in nature that we already like and try to emulate that in a machine, like our mouse, the shape of a stone in a creek that feels nice to the hand. Apple has been a leader in so many ways. I think possibly it's partly due to the fact that when you're a smaller company, when you have a well-controlled market or audience or buyers of your computers. It's like we're a stronger monopoly than Microsoft is, in a sense. When you're that way, you have a little more flexibility. So we introduced things like we were the first to have USB, you know, and jumping to build FireWire into our computers. We were one of the first. We invented the technology. Building cameras right in. A lot of the steps towards the future and sort of disdain the past a little quicker, that's always been very important, especially to Steve Jobs, to look at the technologies that are newer and better and going to change the way we do things.
But, Waz, the record saying that Apple's recent pact with Intel is like consorting with the enemy. On the record saying that Apple ought to spin off its iPod business as fast as possible. That when Apple computers run on the same chips as Microsoft, that's trouble. What about that?
No. There's a very there was one very, very deceitful article written by a reporter in New Zealand. And you know what? If I were to say we Americans have a propensity to solve things with violence. That doesn't mean I do. I say we have a propensity to solve things with violence. It's not the way I think. It's a generalized statement about a crowd. I answered a question, a generalized statement about Macintosh users. Mm-hmm. Don't Macintosh users have something against using Intel? And I said, it's like consorting with the enemy. I explained that philosophy. Mm-hmm. It's not never been my own. I was totally for that move to Intel because our technology should reign. If you can make faster computers with using less power, I mean, I was actually a CPU designer and understand the most important thing is to solve the heat problem. And the move to Intel was really working right on that. So there was a misconception in an article that got copied over and over and over and passed around. And that happens in the news sometimes. Mm-hmm. History gets written and it's wrong very often.
What about the direction of the personal computer, where it's come from, the vision you originally had, where it's headed today? Are you happy with it? Would you like to do you wish something else had evolved here? How do you look at that evolution?
Yeah, my first vision was different, that you would learn how to program like any fifth grader can, and whenever you had a problem, you could write a program to solve it with your computer. You were, in essence, the master of how you use your computer. It turned out very different in very early years that everybody wrote such great, grandiose programs that would do everything for you, managing your toy store, you know, handling your checkbook, that all now it's sort of like you learn to use the way this program was written by someone else. You're almost a slave to their program using it. So it didn't turn out the way we envisioned things back in the Homebrew Computer Club days. The fact that computers would wind up being able to store music and photographs and stuff like that was a technology so far. You know, it's hard to look ahead and be the mm-hmm. futurist type that looks that far ahead, because if you make predictions, I don't like to be wrong. I'm more the engineer that likes to be correct. You can only be correct for maybe about up to a year ahead if you're working in the field. As far as what computers have become, there was some great humanist steps. The Apple II was so open, so many people learned about computers, learned that they had a place in this world, that was their thing. They're the CEOs of almost all the major technology companies now. They'll tell you, they started with an Apple II. So proud of those days that we made something available educationally almost to teach people that there is a way. Well, when the Macintosh came out and the Lisa before it, we introduced the graphical user interface that said computers can be intuitive. They can work the way humans want them to.
We're talking this hour with Steve Wozniak, co-founder of Apple Computer with Steve Jobs and inventor of the personal computer. He's been writing about his life. The book is I Was, From Computer Geek to Cult Icon, or How I Invented the Personal Computer, Co-Founded Apple, and Had Fun Doing It. GJ is calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, GJ. You're on the air.
Hi. Great to meet you, Steve Wozniak.
Oh, good to talk to you.
Thank you. I'm wondering if this revolution of the information age was inevitable. What if there was no Steve Wozniak or Steve Jobs? Moreover, what if there was no Xerox PARC or Microsoft and IBM? Was the popularity and adoption of the PC destiny, or could it have been derailed without the right people?
A lot of people think that way, and I don't have a strong opinion. My main opinion is it would have happened anyway, that the major impetus for it was the falling price of chips. By Moore's law, chips cost less to put the same number of transistors on every year, and eventually the necessary transistors to build a computer were going to be affordable, whatever affordable means. Computers did have some uses for people, so it would have happened. Who knows in what form? I am so thankful just for the Apple part of it, because we made so much of this fanciful games, humor, jokes. We kind of made a light attitude about computers, and for people to accept them in the home. They needed a shape that looks appropriate in the home. They needed, a name like Apple. They needed a lot of positive connections. You know, people happy, Apple a day for the teacher, and all this thing. So it was a much harder job, I think, convincing people that computers were appropriate for the home than designing it was. Thank God the news media was totally on our side in the early days. Lots of real positive articles helped this whole personal computer thing start. It would have started eventually. It had to. Would people have thought of as many great things as I did or others did? It would have taken a different course. I can't really answer that. Maybe I just accelerated something briefly, and in the long run, it didn't even accelerate anything to where we are now. Sometimes when you do things very early, a little before they're right, like the Macintosh maybe was done a little before it was affordable for that type of computer, sometimes you get the world off on a slightly wrong track for cost savings of the day, and it's a long hardship to make up for it and do the computer the full right way eventually.
Steve Wozniak, you've been talking and writing so much about your life and experience lately. Talk to us about this famous relationship, the two Steves. You're quoted here saying Steve Jobs can be annoying to people. He can be obnoxious. He would walk into meetings and just say, forget it, it's all a bunch of junk, you're not doing it, and walk out and say, you're all idiots. You describe very clearly in the book, you know, two different personalities here. Yours, you said sometimes you were on the outs, you were, you know, not socially skilled, and yet from that position you created something amazing. What about the Steve Jobs persona and your ultimate relationship with him? Your great buddies then seem more distant now. How's it evolved over the years?
I have always thought of myself as friends with Steve Jobs. We're still friendly. We've never had an argument in front of people. Some of his activities are described by others that are atrocious, and I never actually personally witnessed them, except maybe I came a couple times close. But
you always tell the truth. He didn't want to write an introduction for your book. He hasn't invited you to work at Apple again, though you've expressed interest. You invited him, as I understand, considered inviting him onto a board of one of your companies. No, thank you, he said. Well, what's the evolution been?
I would actually recently have been interested in getting involved in Apple, and he's nixed that.
Why?
Turn down the forward, but he's never written a book forward. He would have been a good person. I told him just write about how we were back then. He agreed to it, but months and months later, when it was time to write the forward, he declined it very politely and just said, you know, best wishes. I know the book will do well.
But why not an open door at Apple?
Yeah. Why not? 3 days later, the Pixar Disney deal was announced. Yeah. He was busy.
He was busy. We get it. Why not an open door at Apple? Is there a point at which the time for a partnership passes by? Is he afraid of your open-mindedness, you know, with your sort of iconic status that you'd be difficult to handle inside the company?
That could be, but you know what? I am so non-threatening to anyone and so personable. Steve is very good to me and polite to me. He makes sure that I'm always get VIP invitations to the big Apple announcement events and things like that. He has always treated me kindly. He's treated me very, even when I'm like wrong and don't have good thinking in my head, he doesn't treat other people, other engineers that way as when they have bad thinking in their head, maybe because he has a huge respect for me for what I did in those early days. I really can't add much to the Steve Jobs stories, people who had personal experience with him. I wasn't in the same buildings and rooms in the company around him when a lot of his pressure and pressuring engineers to get work done and to get it done a certain way and to poo-poo things that they worked so hard on, they tell me those stories. They're the ones that wouldn't work with him again. I have no problem.
Steve Jobs is in the news again today. Page one, Wall Street Journal. He knew that Apple Computer had manipulated some of its stock option grants. The company says after an internal probe, there's been a lot of concern about stock option grants in the tech industry. Does that sound like something that Steve might get carried away with? What do you think about all that?
I am so non-financial, I don't even know what the exact little minute issue is, and I can't come up with my own opinion. Is it right or wrong? Yes, it's wrong if you sort of deceive shareholders and some people benefit at the expense of shareholders, and that's probably what it is. It looked to me, I read today's paper, said something like about an apology from Steve. I didn't read the article. It's just not my interest, these financial, who's doing this or that. Fraud is fraud, though. If there was, you know, if there was lying and deceit, you got to pay back for that.
Mark is calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. How y'all doing?
We're great. What do you think, Mark?
Well, I think that I'm so fortunate to have a career that's been based around the Apple solution, and I cut my teeth on Apple II.
Yeah.
And it all was the impetus of seeing Death of a Salesman with Dustin Hoffman back in the 80s and just wanted to be more than just a salesman. And the Apple solution provided me a way to I felt like I could contribute to society.
Wow, that's metaphysical. And what now?
Well, now I'm a Segway dealer, and I just would like to hear what Steve's comments are. I know he's a big polo player, and would just like to see if he thinks there's any parallel between the adoption of the Macintosh and the adoption of the Segway PT.
The Segway, the two-wheel personal conveyance machine that there was so much about a couple of years ago. Steve Wozniak, we know you're a big Segway fan. Why? And what about Mark's question?
I'm about the best-known Segway fan. Dean Kamen's a good friend of mine, the inventor, and I was the first one allowed to purchase one as a consumer. And I play Segway Polo. I use them in and out of my life daily. It's so much more convenient than a car, and it has other advantages than a bicycle. A bicycle is a very good thing, too. Some of us that have spine injuries don't ride bikes anymore. So I love the Segway. Now, the Segway is a piece of new modern technology that almost no one would expect. Where did it come from? Two little wheels and gyroscopes that balance you like a helicopter, and you lean forward and it goes forward. Who would have ever expected this thing? So I like to jump into new technologies. I believe that things that are fun for kids can be fun for adults, too. And a bunch of other people bought Segways that are generally outsiders. They're the sort of people that I actually am at heart. Outsiders, they don't have that much going, but they'll try something weird and new because then they don't even have to be compared to others who are making choices. They're the only one that has one. It gives you that extra specialness. It's almost like having a Macintosh makes you one of the special people in the world sometimes because everyone else has PCs. So I love the Segway, and I didn't believe in all of the dreams that would change the world. Those went by pretty quickly. I hoped that it was one of those devices that would be that way. Steve Jobs considered investing $50 million in it, according to the book Codenamed Ginger, written by an author that lived with Dean Kamen throughout the development leading up to the marketing of the Segway. Steve Jobs wanted to invest the money and then couldn't. I called Steve, and I said, wow, the Segway is so great. And he says, yeah, it's fun, but it only does one thing. It doesn't do a million things like a computer does. It really isn't going to take over the world the same as the Apple II.
Yeah. Mark, thanks for your call. Steve Wozniak, what about the future of the United States and technology? There's a lot of hand-wringing about it these days. We don't have enough scientists. We don't have enough engineers. Research is being outsourced abroad. You're the engineer. How do you look at that challenge, that situation?
Times have changed a lot for electronics. There was a lot that, you know, one little person themselves in their own home or bedroom or whatever could put together a few parts that they could buy pretty cheaply on the market and make something significant like an entire Apple II computer. Those days are getting harder to find. Most of the outstanding products now that there's billions of dollars in good technology products, most of those developments are done in designing custom chips, which takes millions of dollars and, you know, huge numbers of months. The typical inventor, the sort of person I really am, wants to sit down with an idea, wire some things together to prove a concept, get it working, show it off, and have very quick feedback.
Does that mean you're irrelevant in this world where it takes millions of dollars? And does it matter if that research is done here or abroad?
Well, one of the advantages was if you worked in a company as an engineer and you had all the tools available and all that. But now we're outsourcing so much engineering. Companies start up and, well, heck, the venture capitalists don't even want to put money in unless you're going to get the engineering costs down by outsourcing it. The engineers are across the world. You can't even have an idea of your own and be in charge of trying it out real quickly. I'm afraid of that invention process going down a bit.
Going down or abroad or both?
It can... You know, it doesn't go away until you've gotten rid of the last laboratory that some clever engineer can go into and try out a neat idea. Maybe he's going to have the idea that changes the world. That comes about randomly. So I say going down, it's pretty much going, there's less of it in the United States. But who cares? We're all citizens of the world. You know, this is my world. If somebody can make a product, can do some work cheaper in Ohio, well, heck, let's hire them to do it in Ohio. They're our friends and brothers. Well, so why don't we treat the other countries like states?
Steve Wozniak,
in India, they can do a job really well. We're so close on the phone and the internet now, we can have good communication, whereas we couldn't before, except for the fact that they're sleeping when we're not.
We've got 20 seconds left. What's your advice to the young geek?
Follow your heart, have some dreams, know who you are. Don't let people tell you, here's a path you got to follow to success in your life. You got to go to these schools, you got to take these classes, you got to do this kind of work, you got to move up the ladder like this. If whatever you feel like doing, if you have the passion to do something and succeed, you will.
Steve Wozniak, co-founder of Apple Computer, author, co-author of I Was. Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Tom.
Steve Wozniak co-founded Apple Computer with Steve Jobs in 1976, invented the personal computer. The new book is I Was, From Computer Geek to Cult Icon, or How I Invented the Personal Computer, Co-Founded Apple, and Had Fun Doing It. He left Apple Computer in 1985. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More at acura.com/RDX.